Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I want to start off by saying that my last broadcast was met, at least by our people, with some very positive reviews. But needless to say, I've taken a lot of crap for it online. What bothers me the most, really, is that it's from people who have never heard it. It's from people who've never listened to it or have read any of my material. In fact, I would say 95% of those attacking me have no idea what I said in that. And that bothers me for a few reasons, because these are otherwise very intelligent people. These, you know, it means that they're dishonest. It means that they believe any rumor that comes their way. You know, it believes that they're really in no position to make decisions on anything. If this is how they respond to something like this, and you start getting accused of all sorts of things that you've never advocated, you know that these people have not taken the hour out of their lives to listen to me, or even to scan any of the documents that I've written myself, that others have on this issue. There's a lot of ad hominem, as you might imagine, because you can't deny any of the facts that I put out there. There's simply no way the statistics, if anything, are understated. There's a lot of pressure on these agencies to lower it. So, I don't know. The dishonesty is what I can't stand. And this is why amateurs in this field really bug me. Because they're susceptible to things like this. They're not going to read it because it's going to offend them too much. Or listen to it, or whatever it is, and so they just make assumptions. When I deal with the Orthodox clergy on nationalism, they just invent the definition just out of thin air, and then pat themselves on the back by being so enlightened as to reject it. Sometimes they say that it's just imperialism. Sometimes they say it's hating one group of people. Sometimes they say it's believing in some sort of superiority. Now, outside of the Jews, I don't know of any major nationalist writer who said we are simply better than those around us. Usually the nationalist writer will say what makes us different is being ignored, including by our own people. It's really illiterate to say that someone's a white supremacist. Because the next question should be, well, in what respect? In what respect are we supreme? In everything? I mean, is that the claim? It's just a stupid name to call someone. I know very few people who you can actually call that. But I define racism the way it's always been defined. And I'll say it again. It's the belief that one's DNA maps out your behavior in some sort of antisocial way. That blacks are programmed in some way to be criminals rather than being conditioned into it. That's what that is. Now, there's an argument for it, one that I don't necessarily share. But outside of that, the word has no meaning. It's whatever the regime dislikes. You know, in the Old Testament, you had two kinds of prophets. You had the real prophets, you know, Isaiah and Amos and the rest, who normally were on their own, very isolated people, very harsh in their speech. Most of them were killed. But people forget about the temple prophets. The system hired and maintained full-time prophets on the dime of the temple. And of course, they told the leadership whatever they wanted to hear. It was the temple prophets that condemned Elijah, and that would poison the ear of whoever was ruling at the time. And my opponents in this respect are the temple prophets of today. It has to have crossed their minds at one point or another that their point of view is precisely that of the New World Order, of the regime. And they're doing its bidding. An important thing that both capitalism and socialism have in common is this belief that race doesn't matter. The only thing is production and markets and the infinite malleability of human nature. Words, generally speaking, are used to conceal meaning, not reveal them. And that's why people like me exist. So it's very frustrating. I mean, 90% of my debates revolve around the notion, you know, that I didn't say that. I don't believe that. I'm sick and tired of it. And of course, none of these people have actually read or listened to it. They heard third hand from someone and they want a virtue signal. So it gets very frustrating. And, you know, unless these people have actually heard it, I don't want to hear from them. I also ask you for your support. This is a particularly a bad time for me and members of my family as well. As tax time comes around, I need your support more than ever to keep this going, to keep me going. I've said this to some of you that have donated, but I'll say it in public now. When I receive money from you, well, first of all, I treat it as God's money, not mine, which is how it should be. So I'm very careful as to where it goes. But it's proof to me that there are people out there who are willing to sacrifice for me. And over the last few years, it's been one of the few things that have kept me going. When I think that no one cares, that it just doesn't matter, someone, you know, sends me a few dollars, and I realize, wait a minute, I do. It's a silly thing to say, but it really, it's been a massive help to me psychologically. As many of you know, it's very, very, very easy to get depressed when you're raped by whether it be the family court system or the tax system or the regime in general. People who are on the nationalist side of things in America know that they're going to be excluded by the apostles of love and openness and tolerance. And yet we fight on anyway, which means that we truly and honestly believe in the truth of the matter. I don't claim that I should be heard because of some abstract First Amendment or some abstract freedom of speech. I have never said that in my entire career, and I never will. I should be heard because I'm right, because I'm factually correct. My interpretations of facts are correct. My predictions almost always come true, and no one pays any attention. So I beg of your financial support. And my website is www.rushjournal.org, and you could donate from there through PayPal. In fact, PayPal is the only account I have. And from my major donors, I send some things that I'm working on, papers and books, really to get your opinion on them. So you get a sneak peek into what's coming in my publishing life. And a lot of you have had a lot of good things to say about it. And it gets you involved in what's going on here, because I don't have the army of research assistants and undergraduates and secretaries that the ordinary professor would have. Those who have donated, again, I thank you very, very much, and it will not be forgotten. Speaking of this struggle, I want to talk about something that has rocked the Orthodox world for several decades now. The situation on Mount Athos, around the monastery of Isfigmenio. This is a very large, really a small city, completely self-sufficient, that in protest against the Patriarch of Constantinople's ecumenical relations and the general corruption of the Fanar, has refused to commemorate, whether it be Demetrius or Bartholomew. Technically, although Athos is a self-governing unit, the Patriarch of Constantinople is the abbot of all the monasteries on Athos, at least the major ones. Not in fact, but in law. And he has demanded, in the name of love and tolerance, the violent eviction of the 110 monks living there, and their replacement with five or six men of his own choosing, who would go in to replace it. This has been an ongoing siege now for at least a decade, if not more, where the Greek police and even special forces have surrounded this place. The Coast Guard has cut everything off from this monastery for many, many years. They don't even allow medicines to come in. Now, only a liberal blockade forbids medicines. In the past, sanctions always made an exception for medications and necessities for the people involved. But here, even medications have been cut off. The same thing goes for the Donbas in Ukraine. Everything. So medications for children have been banned. Cannot be given or sold. The apostles of love are very selective about this. And you guys know where this comes from. In 1924, I know this is very familiar to a lot of people, maybe not everybody, but the Patriarch of Constantinople, that had always been, or at least I should say in the 20th century, a highly suspect institution, and even the end of the 19th century too, altered the calendar to coincide with the Gregorian calendar of the West, with the exception of the Paschalion, the date of Easter. That was a compromise measure. Initially, it was just to go over to the Gregorian calendar. Now, some even old calendarists will say that this was necessary because the new calendar is more correct. And my response is, correct compared to what? There's 1,000 different criteria you could use for a calendar. One isn't more correct than another. But the point had nothing to do with correctness. The point had to do with making the two calendars unified so as to make ecumenical relationships that much easier, to reduce the distinctiveness of the Orthodox world. On Mount Athos, from 1924 on, all the monasteries of Mount Athos refused to commemorate the Patriarch except Vatopedi. 1927, there was a compromise where Athos was permitted to maintain the old calendar. And yet, if Ismenu did not accept this, that wasn't the point. The calendar is not the issue. It's the entire mentality. Why did it have to change? There's nothing more correct than another. There is no absolute standard for the calendar. Of course, it comes right after the encyclical to the Christians of the world. Where all Christians were called brothers and dogmatic differences were rejected. In 1965, Rome and Constantinople lifted their mutual anathemas. which doesn't make any sense from the Orthodox point of view, because you would have to have an ecumenical council to do that. The Patriarch of Constantinople and his bishops, who were mostly bought handpicked men that represent sees that no longer exist, living in the same Fanar district. This was a unilateral move on their part. In 1971, certain freedom was given to Mount Athos here, but even there, Ifismenu always refused. The calendar wasn't the point. 1972 and 1974, during the Greek military government, this is when the Orthodoxy or Death flag was designed, and it became the ensign, it became the symbol of the what we call now the true Orthodox movement. To say old calendar is not really to refer to the calendar. It's to refer to an idea, a traditionalist understanding, independent of the calendar. Traditionalist is simply the way of a much, much easier way of putting it. Usually, old calendars are more nationalist, especially in Greece. So for the first time in 1974, Ifismenu was surrounded by the army, and that flag was unfurled for the first time. This is a very large institution. They're completely self-sufficient. This is what makes Athos so important. If there's anything like a Vatican in Orthodoxy, it's Mount Athos. But it has nothing to do with any kind of juridical control. It's a living example. They are how we should be. Some of you may remember the 60 Minutes episode on Athos from about 10 years ago. It was meant to be a hit piece, stressing how they don't allow women, and this was an archaic institution, etc. That was their instructions as they left America. And when they got there, they were enchanted by the place. One, the cameraman's assistant, stayed, and is a monk today. It wasn't a hit piece at all. It was extremely positive. It was shocking to me to see that, and that there were atheist members of that camera crew. There was about 25 people who converted. Didn't necessarily stay, like the one guy did, but weren't atheists anymore. Things happened to them on this little small tiny peninsula. The average lifespan of an Athenite monk is between 94 and 96, as far as anyone can figure. They're never sick, which is why sometimes medication is not really that big of a deal. They have a tremendous sense of brotherhood. They engage in manual labor their entire lives, sometimes very strenuous. It's all mountains, of course. And carrying blocks up a mountain using chains is not uncommon. You see an 80-year-old man doing this. This is how they stay in shape. They have a very sparse diet with no meat and rarely any dairy. And of course, because of this, heart disease is unknown. Cancer is absolutely unknown because nothing they have there is processed. Sickness, to be honest, including mental illnesses, are simply unknown there. They do have electricity in certain places, not the smaller skeets and hermitages, but they do have electricity at the bigger places with locally made electricity, either using water or wind. And each of these large institutions is completely self-sufficient. They have their own food supply. They have their own water source. They have everything they need. The only thing that the Greek government was able to keep from them was mail, They did have bank accounts on the Greek mainland, which were frozen, which, as far as I know, still are. And for some of the very elderly monks, some medications were necessary. And as far as what I've heard, between 10 and 15 monks have died. Now, these were all very elderly. But they died a more painful death than they would have because of this embargo. In the open letter to all of Mount Athos from the Ephes Menu leadership, the abbot is Methodius, and he oversees about 110 monks, and this is in 1206. He comes out and says very simply that the calendar change had more to do with prayer with Rome than anything else. And remember, the canons very clearly say any prayer with heretics leads to your deposition. The entrance into a Jewish temple or any even association with Jews leads to your deposition. You could have nothing to do with these people, liturgically speaking. How can we be expected to take seriously the lifting of the anathemas when we celebrate, and you celebrate, the murder by the hundreds of Athenite monks by the Latins? He also notes here that we are a nationalist monastery. And this is something that has hit the Europe-wide press pretty hard. They were one of the few monasteries that actually supported the liberation struggle, and in 1821 refused to hand over Emmanuel Pappus, because at the time, Turkey controlled the peninsula. And they were firmly nationalist and refused to hand him over at great cost to themselves. Everyone else simply cooperated with the Turks. Well, on again, off again, from 1974 on, the police or the army have been used to surround the place, trying to intimidate the monastics there, which really has failed. The police have refused to use violence because they're Greeks. And the police have been very careful what they've done. There was one death. This was when a young monk ran his tractor off a cliff trying to get away from one of these cops. Something along those lines. But that's the only death that I know of. But it wasn't until 2005 that the Ecumenical Patriarchate, the EP or the Patriarch of Constantinople, created this alternative group, and they're just his people. Now, I've said on this show many times that the Patriarch of Constantinople is not a pope of the East. He's not a pope of anything. Bishops don't rule anything. They are administrators at most. They don't control grace. They don't say where grace goes. They're not channels of grace. All of us are. You don't need a bishop to be saved. And the church has gone long stretches of time without them. But the Ecumenical Patriarchate under the Turks was in order to take your see there, you had to pay the Turkish government a huge amount of money. And that goes for all the bishops under Turkey. So they were all against the canons. And so you really didn't have a canonical hierarchy anywhere in the Turkish Empire. And what happened is that they would, an ambitious man would go to the Jews at the Fanar, borrow a lot of money, buy a see, and then use his taxing power as bishop of the area to get that money back with interest. Anything above that became profit, which means you had the most devious people taking sees. Some of these people weren't bishops. Some of these people weren't even religious. Most of these people never saw their sees. Most of these people were businessmen or consortium. Ecumenical Patriarchate under the Turks had reached a tremendously low level of prestige. It wasn't taken seriously, and there was no reason to take it seriously. I said before that the Ukrainian Union, one of the reasons that the Unionists affected so many people was that Constantinople, who had direct control over Ukraine at the time, offered them no support. They were either very pro-Western, or in the case of like John Beckwith, several were Lutherans or pro-Lutheran. You had every kind of sleazebag running the place after the Turkish occupation. There was nothing there. There was no support you were going to get from them. But the papacy, of course, after Trent was thriving. So you could see the temptation. In 2005, now the Apostles of Openness, there, you know, there's the main city of Athos is Karyas. And five representatives of Ephesmenu were living there, as is normally the custom. That's where the great council of monasteries sits. And Bartholomew sent his people armed with crowbars, smashed into their room, and while they were sleeping, beat the crap out of them. Five of them ended up in the hospital, had to go for specialized treatment at Thessaloniki. One had his head carved in, but caved in, but was not, but did not die, thank God. They did fight back afterwards with chairs, and you know, they broke the legs off chairs, whatever they can do. But these men were sent by the Patriarch of Constantinople to kill them. In the history of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, that shouldn't surprise anybody. In 2013, a half-hearted attempt, the Greek special forces to storm the monastery failed because these were Greek males in the security services who did not want to hurt these monks. They were armed with stones, Molotov cocktails, homemade weapons of all kinds. They were not expecting resistance, but they got it. And it failed. Which is nothing short of a miracle. Now, this should tell you something. You have a monastery that is like a little city. If you see pictures of it, it's a huge place. Completely self-sufficient in food and water. They've withstood a blockade since 1974. And their lives haven't changed at all. Cruel though it might be. Now, why? I mean, opposed to the historical reasons, why is the Ecumenical Patriarchate in the new calendar such a problem? And I don't think I've actually even mentioned that on this show before. I want to go to Vladimir Moss. Now, Vladimir Moss, I think he has a crush on me. Because whenever I put out an article or a radio show on a certain topic, he has to come out with it a few weeks or months later. I've counted over 25 coincidences like this. The minute I mention a topic, could be the Old Believers or Ivan the Terrible, something like this, he'll have his paper on it within a few weeks. Obviously, he's simply following me. I do think he's got a little man crush on me. The obsession is getting old, Vladimir. The only reason I don't say much is because he doesn't make money off of this stuff. There's a lot of people, like Brother Nathaniel, so many others that you know, plagiarize me all the time. You know, just a thank you, guys. Just say thank you once in a while. Would that kill you? You know, obviously Vladimir Moss is following me here. And one of the ways you know this is that he cites every author relevant to this stuff except me. Which can't be a coincidence. Just say thank you. Really, I'm not asking for very much here. I'm flattered and everything, but come on. You are following me around like a little kid. And now, on the other hand, you know, Vladimir Moss has taught me quite a bit. We're on the same side on a lot of things. I've been reading. He's been doing this for longer than I have. But the man crush is getting old. So someone tell him to, you know, back off a little bit. One article, though, that is excellent of his, that he did not take from me. I'm not saying that he, I don't mean he to cut and paste things of mine. I mean the ideas and the topic he takes from me. He doesn't necessarily agree with me. But he's not lifting, you know, whole paragraphs or anything like that. But he has a great article called 10 Reasons Why the Ecumenical Patriarchate is Heretical. And I want to briefly go through these because this is why this is such a problem. And this is why we need to remember that the church is not the bishops. Bishops don't rule the church. This is a very Western papal idea. This is a bureaucratic idea. Bishops are administrators for, as far as, you know, monasteries and clergy are concerned. And even there have limited power. A bishop is elected by the people, at least ideally, and comes from the monastic life. He is a creation of the monasteries. And when we say a bishop, we don't mean a person necessarily. Traditionally, we meant the diocesan council, not a single person. There's no individual in the pre-modern era. Moss's article is excellent for someone who hasn't come across it. One of the more important reasons is Patriarch Metaxakis, a man who had been deposed over and over again for canonical infractions of all kinds, a man who was openly a 33rd degree Freemason. You had bishops who were involved in his election in the 1920s saying that they were bribed, saying that British money was pouring into the Fanar. Remember, 1920, this is a time where, you know, the Balkans were destroyed. Two Balkan wars, World War I, they were bleeding white. There was no money, there was no power. The British come around with cash. You could see the temptation. 1921, he's elected patriarch. It didn't take long, though, for him to be deposed for all sorts of infractions. Then somehow became Patriarch of Alexandria for some reason. Very, very bizarre situation with him. But as far as I know, well, his mentor, Melaton, this was a Masonic cult within the Ecumenical Patriarchate. This is not something that he would disagree with if he were here. There's pictures of him in his apron and everything else. Something else Moss mentions, and this is often overlooked, is that the renovationist group that was sponsored by the Soviet Union in the early days of the Soviet Union, renovationists were liberal clergy that wanted, you know, no fasting, you know, married bishops, no monks, short services, all this stuff. Just the secularization. What the Novus Ordo did to the Catholics, they wanted for Orthodoxy. They were anathematized by St. Tikhon, Patriarch of Moscow, but they were soon to, their use for the Soviet system really didn't last long. Their churches were empty, despite the force being used to attend them, and Tikhon won, and the Soviets ended up whisking them aside to the dustbin of history. And some of those men did go back in repentance, because they were used. And it wasn't an Orthodox movement, it was a liberal movement. This group was in full communion with Constantinople in the 1920s. When Tikhon was deposed by these people, at the time of the rule of Patriarch Gregory, Constantinople fully supported it and maintained communion with the so-called canonical Church of Russia. And Tikhon wrote in 1924, "Gregory, I think you've been misinformed what's going on here in Russia." The nature of the calendar change, you know, essentially, you know what the liberals often do, and they've done this many times. For some reason, the elections in Montenegro, whether they should separate from Serbia, comes to mind. They kept having elections until the liberals got what they wanted. There always be some excuse. There wasn't enough people. You know, there's some irregularities, whatever. Until there was 50.01% to leave. And they said, "Oh, this one's okay." That's what they did here. They do this all the time. Elections don't mean much to them. They know that they don't really have popular support, like the renovations never did. And so their elections are always a sham. And the calendar, the time the calendar change, so many of the bishops of Constantinople were dismissed anyway. And a new group brought in, a small group, dependent on Metaxakis and probably Freemasonic, who then voted on it. So it wasn't legitimate even from that point of view. Patriarch Athanagoras, in 1949, flying to Greece on President Truman's plane. President Truman, also high-ranking Freemason, both were 33rd degree. During his enthronement speech, he said, "It's time for these divisions to fall, and all Christians are one just as they stand now." Jacobus in the United States, who was essential in the civil rights movement in America, was also the 33rd degree. Their connection with ecumenism. Now, what ecumenism comes up a lot, and it's a word, you know, it's like racism. It gets thrown around. It doesn't have a definition. What do we mean? Ecumenists say that doctrine has nothing to do with grace or salvation. In other words, truth and salvation have nothing in common. It doesn't matter what you believe so long as you have a good heart. Stupid comments like this. Well, the church historically has never taken that seriously. What you believe do matters, because what you believe affects how you behave. Athanagoras had lifted the anathema unilaterally with the Pope of Rome and fully and completely concelebrated with the Roman pontiff. Demetrius, I don't know if Demetrius was a Mason or not, included the Pope's name in the diptychs, which is the official list of churches that are one with Constantinople. I believe that was in 1974. This is why Efes Menou unfurled the Orthodoxy or Death flag. This is the garbage that they're dealing with. 1975, another Athanagoras. Spoke of a church without doctrine, a church without walls. The Roman Catholics and the Anglicans have full grace just as much as we Orthodox do. And that was when Metropolitan Philaret of the Synod in Exile in America wrote his sorrowful epistles. And things are happening at the Fanar that we can't be silent about. This is when Mount Athos began to revolt. And this is from the point where you get this idea that recognition from the ecumenical patriarchate is what canonical means. Now, if there's anything more illiterate and ignorant than saying that, I'd like to hear it. I've heard it by many clergy. The canonical church is the big one, the one that everyone knows, what the Patriarch of Constantinople accepts. The lack of knowledge of the canons, lack of knowledge of history here, is overwhelming. And it's said all the time. No. To be canonical, surprisingly enough, is to follow the canons. Canons are not laws in the same sense that the Pennsylvania Penal Code are laws. That's a modern conception. These aren't, we're not positivists here. This is the expression of the church's experience. They're very abbreviated. Words can only go so far to understand these things. They create a Archbishop Auxentius used to call it what the walls of Constantinople used to protect are something along the lines of what the canons do. They provide the outer limit. There are two kinds of canons, dogmatic and disciplinary. The former, of course, can't be touched. The latter are touched all the time. The canons of St. John the Faster are almost entirely ignored. They're so strict that no one would be a Christian if they were imposed in force. People say that a priest can't get married for a second time, even if his wife left him and abandoned him. But they ignore the canons that say that if a priest masturbates more than once, he is deposed from his office. That, however, is ignored. That a priest's wife must be a virgin, or he cannot be ordained. In other words, she had to have been a virgin when they got married, which most certainly would leave me out. Seeing that trollop in a white dress, made me laugh, but I married her anyway. So these canons are thrown by the wayside all the time. And of course, canons against, usury and canons that say in favor of monarchy, these are just thrown under the bus all the time. The canons that are ignored are those that exist at a time where the standards could be higher. We're born and raised in a society where we are hardwired by the sexual revolution. That is not our fault. Most of us are hardwired by this long before we come to the church. So we read the very strict canons of John the Faster. Okay, if I was born in the year 1000, I could see. But that's certainly not how anyone could possibly live today. So they are ignored, overwhelmingly. The virgin thing, the menstruation thing, all these things, most of these canons, the disciplinary canons, are completely and totally ignored. In fact, you read through them, and you realize that simply because times have changed, these canons no longer hold fast. Like, for example, a priest can't go to a tavern, or he is deposed. Well, a tavern meant something quite different back then than it does today. Maybe not that different, but that wouldn't be enforced today. But when we talk about ecumenism, we're talking about, let me quote these people here. Athenagoras said the following: "We are in error and we sin if we think that the Orthodox faith came down from heaven and that the other dogmas, the other religions, are unworthy. 300 million have chosen Mohammedanism, Islam, I should say, as the way to God. Hundreds more, millions, Protestants, Catholics, Buddhists. The aim of every religion is to make man better." End quote. This is official doctrine of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. Now, they are founding members of the World Council of Churches. Anyone who was a part of the World Council of Churches cannot be Orthodox, because in 1961, they adopted the following statement: "We consider that the work of creating the one universal church must unfailingly be accompanied by the destruction and disappearance of certain outmoded traditional forms of worship." The Ecumenical Patriarchate said in 1963, "It would be utterly foolish for the true believer to pretend or to insist that the whole truth had been revealed only to them, that they alone possess it. Such a claim would be both unbiblical and untheological. Christ did not specify the date nor the place that the church would suddenly take full possession of the truth. Yet Christ claimed to be the truth. It's a laughable statement. The Department Nectario said this in 1992. Even when hundreds of Roman Catholic priests abandon the priesthood and have their church during the past three decades, the Orthodox Eastern Church systematically avoided receiving them into her bosom in order to avoid poisoning her relationship with the Elder Church of Rome. And when whole parishes in Europe and Italy, for example, wanted to embrace Orthodoxy, once again, we shut our doors to them, since Orthodoxy is persuaded that she doesn't need proselytism. She preferred to leave thousands of former Roman Catholics by themselves and without guidance. Now, this was said in an approving way. This is something that should have been done. My question is, why? Who is this satisfying? The typical Orthodox person doesn't want this sort of thing. Certainly the low-level clergyman doesn't want this sort of thing. Certainly the monks don't want this sort of thing. So who's being served here? When we talk about connecting ourselves with the Roman Church or the Church of England, we're not referring to traditional entities. The Roman liturgy was rewritten by a committee imposed in 1971. Protestants wrote that liturgy. It has no connection with the liturgy of Trent or any Roman Catholic liturgy. It was simply an invention of a bureaucracy. I should say the same for Cranmer's liturgy that has become modernized over the years. It's not Anglicanism, it's modernity. And because of this, Roman Catholics have no real standards for Mass. And very infamously, they have, you know, clown Masses, and they have football Masses, and they have all of these, because there are no standards anymore. If the Mass can be written by a committee in 1971 and imposed on everybody, on pain of excommunication, that means anything goes. The only thing that they could be looking at is money. The Rothschilds do the Vatican's banking. There's a very close connection. Once the fall of the House of Medici was clear, the Rothschilds and the British took over. There's money there. And both the British, the British in particular, have spent a fortune in the East. But you're not even talking about a traditional organization. Patriarch Bartholomew said this, who's, you know, the patriarch today. Those of our forefathers from whom we inherited this separation were the unfortunate victims of the serpent who was the origin of all evil. They are already in the hands of God, the righteous judge. And these men, being the causes of schism, are now in the hands of God, the righteous judge. Now this he said in 1998, and he said it to a papal delegation on November 30th. He comes out and says here that for those who were involved in the schism between East and West are in hell right now. That's what he means by saying the righteous judge twice. That there is no difference. It's one church. October 31st, 1997, he says this. If the diverse peoples of a culture look to the memories of their faith tradition, whatever they may be, they will be sustained. They'll be fed the food of God's spiritual knowledge. Orthodox Christian and modernist, Protestant and modernist, Jew and modernist, Catholic and modernist, however we worship, as long as we abide in our faith and unite it to the works in the world, we bring the living and always timely message of divine wisdom into that modern world. He said this in Atlanta, Georgia. Again, in 1994, he said this in his address to the Sixth World Assembly of Religion and Peace in Italy. Brothers and sisters, the watchword of Holy Orthodoxy is unity. We are learning unity within our own house. we must pursue unity with all the children of God. Roman Catholic, Orthodox, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, Confucians. The time has come not only for rapprochement, but for alliance and joint effort. We have within our grasp the vision of the psalmist. Behold how good and how pleasing it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. We pledge to you today that the Orthodox Church will do everything in her power to fulfill that vision. See, this is the sort of thing, and it's at this particular time, that the bureaucracy of Constantinople became the central watchword. Same thing happened in the Soviet Union, the Moscow Patriarchate. The faith was unimportant. I just proved it to you. They don't care about the faith. It has no meaning to them. It's just one of many. You could do whatever you please. That's what he just said, and he says it over and over again. You see, when you're in communion with somebody, we say we're in communion with such and such, it means that we are in substantial and fundamental agreement in the faith. Not just on a few things, but we are of one mind. We live in one house, so to speak. That's what communion means. So you can't be in good conscience and be in communion with these people, or those who are in communion with these people. Serbia and Bulgaria pulled out of the National World Council of Churches. That's fine. The Patriarch of Serbia continues to light the menorah every year. And they're invited to the Fanar all the time. Some of you may have forgotten that the Church of Antioch has fully opened, it has now full relationships with the Monophysites and the Unians. Anything goes. This is what Ephesmenu is at war with. This is what orthodoxy or death means. There isn't a neutral ground. Either orthodoxy is true, is factually correct, is historically correct, is morally correct, is theologically correct, metaphysically correct, or something else is. God loves the human race. He's going to make sure that his truth is known to us. And we could accept it, we could reject it, we could pretend it's not there. But truth and love go together for that very same reason. I know we lie to our kids when we say, you know, something terrible happened to you. You know, we discipline them that way when they're little. But as they get older, we don't. You never lie to your kids then. No good parent would. Truth and love go together. If you go to the webpage of the this make-believe group that's supposed to be the Ephesmenu Brotherhood, every article, almost every article, with a few exceptions, has the word love in it and tolerance. That's all these people care about. It's a feel-good church. It's absolutely meaningless. Except when they talk about the rebel monks in Ephesmenu, then all of a sudden, that's all gone. Now they become hardcore. What's happened on Mount Athos is that the Ecumenical Patriarchate has forced its own candidates on many of the local monasteries, at least the Greek ones. Because the only way that Bartholomew and that bunch could function is through force. Now, you have congregations like the Antiochian in America that goes along with this. I mean, they actually believe this is the suburban, manicured lawn, new calendar suburban, this kind of conformist middle class garbage. You know, this is just one faith experience out of many. You do have a church like that is entirely cut off. I think most of the OCA is totally cut off. But remember, we err when we talk in terms of groups. Bishops and certainly synods don't tell us where grace is. They have certain characters and they have a certain purpose. But I've been to many Antiochian parishes and everyone is dead. they're upper class, they're more concerned with resale value and equity than they are with anything else. The canons are abstractions that were important many years ago, but don't affect them. Yes, they'll condemn masturbation to the skies, but not usury. Because, well, the fathers really didn't mean, well, they were ignorant. They didn't know anything back then. Science has taken us far beyond all that. Now, the abbot of Ephesminus says that these men operate on the principle of fear. That's what we said in the last broadcast, too. These clergy who sign these stupid anti-racist documents do it because they're scared. They do it because they're afraid they're going to lose their jobs. They're going to lose their homes. They're not going to be invited to the latest Republican Party cocktail party. They're going to lose their status. And for Methodius, the World Council of Churches is the issue. What's shocking is that people who care nothing about the canons, who want union with the Protestants, who have no dogmatic beliefs whatsoever, will spit at us and say that we're not canonical. My favorite example is the Western Rite of the Church of Antioch in this country. It is the closest thing to a joke that I've ever seen. I know the Western Rite extremely well. It's very much a Byzantine rite if you see it done properly. I was shocked when I first saw it. A handful of people in Antioch are doing an Anglican rite, a post-Cranmer rite, with statues and post-schism saints and rosaries and May crownings and all this stuff. They're Anglican people. They believe that Orthodoxy is the place where the Anglican tradition could be more properly kept. And these Anglicans will look at someone like me and say, we're not Orthodox. The gall of these people, the gall of the ignorance of these people, the astounding, overwhelming contempt for the truth that they have. And they believe that they're Orthodox because Phil Saliba said so, or because the Patriarch of Constantinople says so, as if that makes any difference. We're in an age now where recognition by the major sees is not a sign of truth at all. It's a sign of its opposite. The truth is completely marginalized now. The truth has no mainstream representation. Everything is lies. Everything is illusion. Don't forget, the Freemasonic Order. You have clergy in America and all throughout Greece. The 19th degree is where they make their oath to Lucifer. Lucifer is the light giver. Now, there are some lines in there. It sounds like we're rejecting him. But the 19th degree oath and the literature on it says that this is where you learn that God is light. And the light bearer is Lucifer. This is what all high-level Masons have connected themselves to. The 17th degree is based on the Zohar, their communion with Judaism, bringing about the reign of Adam Kadmon, or Antichrist. That Buddha, their first legislator, which is in the 18th degree. There are no gods whatsoever in that degree. They're only philosophical concepts. This is what Masonry teaches at its most conservative American branches. God knows what the French do. Love and tolerance goes out of the way when it comes to nationalism and true orthodoxy. This is why I do what I do. Ephesmenu are heroes. They're us. And there's many lessons we could learn from them. People like us need your support. I've given to FSMNU in the past, although it has to go through weird channels because everything is frozen. You know, we help one another. Orthodoxy or death should be our watchword. We should have that everywhere. It is a sacred ensign now for us. And this is why, and this is what it means. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.